Hello, listeners. Welcome back to Weird Era, a literary podcast where we ask the right questions. Today, I'm joined by Eliza Barry Callahan to discuss her novel, The Hearing Test. Eliza Barry Callahan is a writer, artist, and musician from New York City. Her work has been published in Freeze, Bomb, and The Believer. She received her MFA in writing from Columbia University and was named a 2023 New York Foundation for the Arts Fellow. The Hearing Test is her first novel. When the narrator of The Hearing Test, an artist in her late 20s, awakens one morning to a deep drone in her right ear, she's diagnosed with sudden deafness but is offered no explanation for its cause. As the specter of total deafness looms, she keeps a record of her year, a score of estrangement and enchantment, of luck and loneliness, of the chance occurrences to which she becomes attuned while living alone in a New York City studio apartment with her dog. Through a series of fleeting and often humorous encounters with neighbors, an ex-lover, doctors, strangers, family members, faraway friends, and with the lives and works of artists, filmmakers, musicians, and philosophers, making meaning becomes a form of consolation and curiosity, a form of survival. At once a rumination on silence and a novel on seeing, The Hearing Test is a work of vitalizing intellect and playfulness, which marks the arrival of a major new literary writer with a rare command of form, compression, and intent. And I will just say, I agree with that last line wholeheartedly. Hi, Eliza. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start by asking you about the line between biography and fiction. In French literature, I'm never sure if this is a term used in other literary spheres, but there's an entire genre called autofiction that's very close to the writer's real life experience. But, you know, certain smaller details are where you find the fiction. In what ways would you classify The Hearing Test as an autofictional novel? And why not just write memoir?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's funny to begin with a little anecdote. I was actually speaking to Kate Zambrano last night for the launch. And we were talking a bit about autofiction, and I kind of, you know, hung my head low. She was like, "You're admitting that it's autofiction," as though I should, it's an embarrassing thing. And I said, "Oh, I should, let's rewind the tape." But I had, I was in LA for the month last month, and someone asked me, they asked me about my writing, and I was like, I guess it could be classified as autofiction. And they were like, writing about cars, like, that's incredible. And I didn't correct them. I was like, I do write a little bit about a sob. I do write a little bit about a sob. And we kind of let it roll, but I'd never heard of autofiction as I thought about it in that way. I think that autofiction in the case of my book, and not as far as writing about cars, I would say that the text began as a log. I don't like to refer to it as like a journal or diary, because it really avoided kind of any form of like interiority. It was really concerned kind of with an experiential kind of relationship to kind of the daily. So the book began as in these kind of fragments that existed kind of modularly almost. I wasn't seeing them as something that was linear per se. And they, because I was experiencing at that time hearing loss and this kind of, in the early days of writing the book, did not understand its cause. I was not in treatment. I was told that I was likely going to be losing my hearing within kind of the scope of the year. I was experiencing a kind of massive sensory relational shift in relation to my life. And so I was just kind of concerned with logging it. And I kind of referred to it in hindsight as like a survival document. But I was not writing anything close in my mind to a narrative. It was only after I had actually entered remission and had regained hearing which was something that I had not expected, because that course of that year and a half, which did overlap with the kind of peak of the pandemic, was a year in which I was just kind of moving through what it would be to live a life in relationship to the world that I had not expected to live, one that I had not previously lived. So it was, at that point, I wasn't thinking of it in any way as memoir either, but more as a kind of a log, or almost like a travel log in which someone doesn't go anywhere. and so it was only after the fact, and after I had kind of lived through this kind of moment or this kind of durational moment, that I then went back and I kind of, the caulking or the grout became the fiction of the kind of document. And I think it is fiction. The document is fiction. It is not memoir in any way, and I'm definitely very conscious of that. I was conscious of not wanting to kind of write a medical book or a quote unquote like sick girl book, and to write a kind of experiential document. And it felt like having a kind of narrative arc, however light touch that may be, kind of came after the fact. And it was, I was never seeing it as like memoir, but more as just like a log that then I wove kind of fictional moments into definitely non-fictional moments.
And I mean, following up on that, there are so many instances and anecdotes about real life people and artists. They litter the novel, but specifically I'm thinking about the aside about Ingrid Bergman and Isabella Rossellini or the John Cage story that feel too real to be fiction. I'm not sure if you've read Biography of X by Catherine Lacey, but it kind of gave me that same vibe. And in this moment, I don't need you to tell me what's real and what's not, but I'm more curious about what interests you in writing about other artists.
I love Catherine Lacey. I actually haven't gotten a chance to read Biography of X yet, but that's top of my list. But I think that especially a lot, I will say that a lot of the dates and the coincidences that happen throughout the book, those are quote unquote real, whatever that word might mean in the context of the book. But when I was going through that experience, and I think when one goes through an experience, when they're removed from the kind of context of their life and you are kind of stuck with yourself looking for answers or understanding why this happened, or this kind of, I think I wanted a narrator to kind of reflect this state of I've kind of referred to it as like a relentless exteriority. So it, not wanting to look inward, doing it, feeling their world closing in on themselves and doing anything but wanting to look at oneself and wanting to look outward. And this narrator, like myself, as someone who's incredibly engaged and interested in art and literature in these certain ways. And I think illness is a very solipsistic experience. And so I think this narrator was just kind of relating relentlessly back to herself, or looking for answers, creating these tenuous connections that actually then end up kind of holding weight, or trying to understand meaning or connection or coincidence in relation to understanding why we inhabit the position that we're inhabiting in our lives at that time. So I think the artists that are brought into dialogue were people that I myself was thinking about at the time, it was definitely not like a conscious, like, I want to bring up this artist and now this artist, but it was kind of this associative web that ended up kind of unspooling. I wanted the text to have this kind of unconsciousness to it, or a subconscious associative quality that I think happens, especially in kind of sick time when you're looking for answers or looking for reason or looking to draw connection.
I've been tending to read and interview a lot of New Yorkers lately, And I'm always interested about how different writers write about New York City. Yours is a novel set in New York, but I wouldn't necessarily say New York is, you know, a quote character per se, as a lot of writers like to make it. From what I understand, and maybe you'll correct me here, you're a born and raised New Yorker?
I am, yes. I've never lived anywhere else.
I find New Yorkers and you know, a lot of the novels that I read are from people who have moved there later in life. So I'm wondering if you think there's a difference between writing about New York from your perspective, from somebody who's, you know, born and bred, versus from somebody who is coming in later on.
Yeah, that's a fun question. I feel like perhaps if you're not from here, you're more like starry-eyed, or I don't know, something about like engaging with like the city as this kind of physical prop is more exciting. But when you've existed in it and that's kind of the context that you're born into, that maybe is naturally falls away as something that feels like less like a texture to tap into, and more, I think I'm very concerned with the people who inhabit the city, or these kind of, yeah, slipping into these conversations with kind of characters or like city dwellers who feel like to me are what I kind of associate with the city, or kind of entering a conversation with someone who's kind of led several lives and who lives above you or below you, or who you happen to meet in passing, these kind of chance encounters that to me are what kind of make the city really special and what I associate with the place. I was saying I spent last month in Los Angeles, which totally great place, but I really missed missed the kind of texture of like encounter. I also do kind of find myself entering these kind of conversations where people overshare with me. Somehow, I don't know how I end up in these contexts, but yeah, the apartment feels like a really important, like, quote unquote unit, no pun intended, for understanding the city to me. So I think that's a way in which I engage with it, in the kind of unit of the apartment, the kind of being stacked on top of one another, and yeah, these kind of encounters. That to me feels like maybe how I orient towards the place.
This is funny. I didn't even write this down or anything, but, and I think you just kind of said it, but do you talk to your neighbors a lot?
Well, you know, I'm a little concerned about the publication of this book, because an auto part of the book is definitely the apartment, which I'm speaking to you from, which does have a shower in the kitchen, does have neighbors quite close to the ones that I kind of describe in the book. And yeah, I'm hoping they don't read the book.
I think I'm just thinking about, I'm in Montreal, and I'm always kind of curious when I do go to other places, and I've spent time in New York, and I always wonder if it's a language thing, because we're very bilingual here, but you never really know if you're going to have to end up speaking French, if you're going to end up having to speak English. So when I read stories like this, and there are several moments where, yeah, your narrator just kind of has these random one-off conversations with a neighbor, a landlady, a random person at a shop, you know, it kind of jars me in a way. So I'm always just curious about those, like, very random street-level interactions.
These chance encounters. Yeah, I think that, like, you have to be open to inviting them somehow. It's kind of like someone's walking, you're like, oh, I love, the neighbor's like, oh, I love your suitcase. Like, is it new? And they're like, well, I just came back from Hokkaido, where my lover is living. And then you just kind of, then it kind of just goes, and you maybe ask a few questions, but you learn to actually just let them speak. I think also in New York, a lot of people are like, both overstimulated and lonely. A lot of people like live alone. And so at least in kind of the type of building that I live in, which is like kind of these small kind of studio apartments, a lot of people have been residents here for a really long time. And then there's the kind of turnover of the kind of newer residents. And I think, yeah, I think there's like, people are like in their little boxes and their units, and then their kind of community is just how they interact with the world. So I think there's also some like, if you just like open the door a little bit, you realize there's like desperation for like sharing. And yeah, so much as like complimenting or saying you like, yeah, a bag or, oh, I bought pears yesterday. Like I see there are pears in your see-through tote, you know? And then it's like, I grew up on a pear farm, and then you, you know? So I think there are ways to like invite it that I don't do consciously, but I think people will be like, Eliza, you end up in conversations with like random people. Like we have to go. Like I do love to, I love talking to people. But yeah, so I think that's maybe reflected in the book. And I think part of the terror of my experience was losing kind of ways of communicating. And I think the narrator, I wanted to reflect in the narrator, this kind of desperation for kind of contact or in touchness with a kind of outer world. And so finding a way to fold in these kind of anecdotes in which the narrator wants to kind of find ways to relate herself back to, or find some kind of grain of meaning for herself, and was like an important, yeah, thing to bring in.
And in that same vein, where this might not necessarily, you know, like a novel set in New York City that isn't necessarily about New York City, and maybe all of this just really comes down to personal style, but The Hearing Test does not come across as, you know, quote, an internet novel that so many millennial writers gravitate towards these days. There's not a lot of texting in this novel. There's writing to friends. When the hypnotherapist's call, Zoom call fails, the screen doesn't freeze, the image does. The question here is, are you over this age of internet novels, or are you just over the language?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think I was like conscious that I wanted to write something, of course, that was very contemporary. But I also think like part of it is that I'm kind of like a Luddite, and I'm not like super on the internet. and there's like so much to admire in contemporary fiction. And yet I'm not super engaged in it. Though I really want to be, and I feel like contributing to it, I also like should have a better understanding of what it is I'm kind of throwing words into. But yeah, I think it just comes down to the fact, really simply, that it's maybe just a reflection of like how I see those things, or how I interact with those things. But yeah, I think there is a consciousness of thinking about it as like not having it feel internet-y, though I don't think that was something I really had to try, because again, I'm not super like on the web.
Do you think that is because of romanticism, and do you think you're a romantic?
I don't know. I think I'm a nostalgic person, for sure. I think romantics and nostalgics are like pretty like married in some way. I definitely am a romantic to a degree. I think I was conscious of just kind of pulling back as much kind of dressing around the writing or things, and just not having things feel like associated with things like the internet, these things, just kind of creating a more timeless, not like that I'm saying like I made something timeless, but that I was concerned with not having it be rooted in time, even though I, of course, didn't want to deny its existence in the current day. But yeah, I think there's a degree of Yeah, I don't know if in this text it was like romanticizing or being like, I'm of another time, but more just that I feel like out of date a little bit. Like, I'm just like a little behind, not like I'm in like the 1800s. More like, yeah, I'm just a little out of the loop.
So then similarly, and jumping off of that one, towards the end of the hearing test, we enter 2020, and you do not explicitly mention the pandemic or the lockdown, but there is a part of me that was kind of waiting for it the whole time, because I was thinking, you know, this is going to be the crux of the novel. This is going to be an extremely tumultuous period for Eliza, for your narrator. But in what ways did the pandemic not fit into this for you?
Yeah, I think it's funny. I thought about how if I wanted to include it, but I actually never actually really considered it. I started losing my hearing and entering this kind of period really like 2 months before the pandemic hit. And mm-hmm. I really had to enter quite serious isolation. There's actually a photo of me flying to LA where I was seeking this particular type of treatment, and I'm wearing a 3M like N95 mask, and it's 2 months prior to the pandemic. I kind of entered this like locked. I had developed severe hyperacusis, which is sometimes a byproduct of people who are losing their hearing, especially due to kind of a sensorineural hearing loss, which is I became incredibly sound sensitive. So you have this situation where even though you're losing frequencies of what you can hear, the sounds you do hear are incredibly abrasive. It almost magnified strangely. So it's this very weirdly loud experience, even though you actually can't hear as well. And so it was so hard to even talk. I've tried to explain to some people as it's almost like you're plugging your ears. When you plug your ears, your own voice becomes louder. Or if you're kind of underwater, like speaking underwater in a bathtub, which I don't know why one would do, but I'm sure you have. So I had entered this extreme kind of feeling of isolation and loss prior to the pandemic. And I knew that I was writing a book on isolation, and that actually people having experienced the kind of pandemic, which was this, again, this durational experience, which was almost identically overlapped in the kind of timeline of my kind of acute experience, mm-hmm. As far as like lockdown is concerned. And I didn't want it to be rooted in that moment or associated specifically with that moment, but I knew that I wanted to kind of tap into this kind of feeling of a kind of an isolated state.
I would actually like to talk about the calmness of this novel. It doesn't feel like there's any huge panic surrounding the narrator's diagnosis. I kept kind of thinking, if this happened to me, I think I would just be constantly freaking the fuck out, but fictional Eliza doesn't necessarily, or at least doesn't on the page. She approaches the situation very coolly, and you've actually said in this interview that it's very external, but I would almost argue to say that it's extremely internal. I would love to hear your thoughts on this, and maybe just your thoughts on what dictates composure.
I think that the narrator is panicked, but it's a controlled kind of repressed panic, I would argue. So it's like a panic that is again externalized in kind of this relentless looking for answer or reason or help or cause in a way that I think, I was concerned with trying to have a narrator that was clearly in pain or desiring to know or find reason or to kind of understand and also at simultaneously to avoid. I think in many ways she's not totally relinquished herself to the reality of her situation in some way. I think that's the kind of endless answer searching, is this avoidance of an acceptance of reality. So she actually doesn't allow herself to panic because she's avoided the actual circumstance, which is that she will lose a sense. And that, I think, is maybe the thing that relates to like her not seeming panicked, is that she actually won't allow for it because she's avoiding the reality, which is that. And instead, she's looking for answer or reason in this kind of external sense. And I think external in the sense that it's this looking or seeing. And I think I was interested in trying to find intimacy and closeness with a narrator where we get to know her through what she sees and how she perceives, because I think as one loses a sense, another sense is heightened. So I was really concerned with kind of this looking and seeing and learning from someone by how they see and think in relation to how they see, but seeing as the kind of ground. And I was thinking quite filmically. I was thinking about her in a room in this almost kind of filmic sense, and maybe less in like a textual sense. That makes sense.
I think it does. And, you know, hopping off of that one again, it's a novel that's just punctured by human interaction. And although your narrator is very, you know, controlled and pensive, I'd almost say a lot of the story is told through other people. It's, again, you know, it says it in the book description, neighbors, landlords, friends, ex-lovers. There is this huge focus on how this narrator interacts with those around her, and specifically, she listens. And I would like to hear you talk a little bit more about that. And when I say that, I think I mean the importance of listening.
Yeah, I think, again, it's like as you're losing something, you kind of desire that thing even more intensely. So this desire to kind of reach out and hear people's stories, or to really hear them in a way that perhaps she hadn't kind of concerned herself with prior. I think an important kind of quiet motor in the book for me when I was thinking about it was the ex-lover, because I think through the text, she's grappling with this loss of hearing, but she's also, which I think serves as a container to avoid her grappling with the loss of a relationship that she kind of hasn't totally confronted in some way. And these kind of losses in the end, kind of, she accepts them in some way, or they're kind of, they kind of come to the surface together in some way. The things that one has avoided, kind of how they kind of arrive. And I think in the end, it's a kind of a question of a certain acceptance. And I think that kind of arrival in my mind was coming through these kind of relentless dialogues, or these kind of talking through or listening. She was looking for answers outside, and by looking for answers, that meant kind of engaging with these people who are often like elders in some way.
Do you think people need to listen more in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's something that I also tried to kind of give as a kind of directive to myself, which is to just kind of slow down and listen, and kind of be open to the other people's stories. I was speaking about this last night a bit as well, but I grew up as an only child in New York City. My parents were older when they had me. I was raised, you know, very much constantly with them and around them and their friends and their communities. I was very much raised by a community of adults. And I was often the only kid in the room. And I think that kind of predisposed me to kind of being engaged or interested in listening to these kind of certain characters, which do kind of appear in some way throughout the book. And my kind of interest in hearing, hearing these kind of people share their stories. But I think that was also, yeah, I was predisposed to this kind of position because I was raised just around kind of a community of kind of a very interesting, very idiosyncratic people that, you know, I was like an 8-year-old in a room of like 60-year-olds who all had very specific kind of individual stories and often no children themselves.
I'm going to jump then to a different question, which is actually a specific quote that I'd like to read and then we'll talk. The quote is, "I often thought about whether I would prefer a happy childhood or a happy adulthood. If that option had been extended to me like a choice of meal on an airplane. The answer seemed obvious, but then I thought about it and it was no longer clear what I would choose." This one really made me think because, you know, the answer for most people, I imagine, would be both. But I'm also wondering if you're saying something about happiness and adulthood being potentially unachievable. Am I being pessimistic? How would you answer this question now?
Yeah, I don't know if I have an answer to the question, but I think it's definitely something that the narrator was thinking about. I was definitely thinking about a certain time of, this question of if you're lucky enough to have a happy childhood, then your adulthood actually can't be happy because you'll be nostalgic for this thing that was like this successful like unit of time and that like you can't recover that. Whereas like people who have unhappy childhoods, like there's only up, like you can only go up from there. And I think my narrator, obviously she wasn't placing herself in either category, but I think at that point she was aware that she was probably going to be unhappy. She was reckoning with the fact that because of her new circumstance, she was afraid she wouldn't be able to achieve or like locate the type of like contentness that she once had located. And I think that was like, that's like one of the instances of like very like caped panic where it's like avoidance of actually being like, my life isn't going to be what I wanted it to be. And more thinking about her position in relation to what it had been, not totally admitting the terror, but raising questions around it or dancing around it. But yeah, I don't think I have an answer. I think I would take adulthood at this point because I'm here.
But I mean, even from what it sounds like, what you were just saying, it seemed like you had an interesting childhood, to say the least. Do you think you had a happy childhood?
Oh, yeah, I feel ultimately very grateful for my childhood. And I'm lucky to have a good relationship with my parents, whom I love very much. I think the narrator, was more thinking about everything relationally. So like, could it only get worse or could it only get worse from here? It could only get better from here. These kind of, setting up these almost, binaries of existing, which is ultimately not useful. But when we enter these kind of patterns of thinking, I think getting into those kind of wormholes of unproductive thought, which is a neighbor to like dread or doom.
It's all very existential.
Yeah.
I do want to highlight one more quote from the novel. It is, "I told the hypnotherapist this was a disengaging strain of fear. He asked me if I felt I was waiting for something. I said yes, it felt like I was waiting for a scene in a film I had seen many times. Yes, it was exhausting to live with this level of anticipation, and what I was anticipating was nothingness. What advice would you give people who experience this? And, you know, like, specifically, I feel as if this is a sentiment shared by people who live with depression, for example. And I'd love to hear if you think there is a way to combat it, or maybe what you did specifically to combat it.
Yeah, I think it's really hard. I think, like the narrator, I had considered myself to be a content person prior to this event in, you know, the scheme of things. Mm-hmm. Life is hard. But but yeah, this really threw me into a headspace that was deeply unfamiliar. And like the narrator, I think I found a different kind of well in myself, a kind of well of emotion, of self-knowledge that, you know, at the time I was like, I don't want to know this part of myself. At this point, being on the other side, I'm really grateful actually for the experience. I think that for me, the thing that kind of got me through this period, which was intensely dark, was actually this document, which, yeah, became, yeah, this kind of survival document. And though I had absolutely no intentions of turning it into a novel or something to be consumed by anyone, I felt a sense of purpose towards the document and towards this log. Again, yeah, like almost like, yeah, a travel log for a journey to nowhere, from upstairs to downstairs or to the grocery store. But yeah, it was kind of locking into a pattern or a routine that was directly mine, and that felt like I was reflecting myself somewhere in this kind of finite sense that just kind of reminded me of my like presence or existence. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I was thinking a lot about the artist Hanna Darboven, who I mention a little bit in the book, who is, I guess she's like a minimalist kind of conceptualist artist. She worked a lot in these kind of calendrical patterns of marking and annotation that were entirely her own,
right,
kind of inscrutable to anyone but herself. And I was interested in that, in this kind of, in having just my own language or space. I was thinking about like Valser's microscripts, or these kind of different things that are, of course, that was something that could be translated and read ultimately, but thinking about just something that I was kind of reflecting just for myself, and being really regimented about it, or being, you know, feeling an allegiance to the document. And yeah, when I sent in the final edit, I actually really like felt this like total loss of the thing that I had added to in this kind of really like pointillist fashion, because it was just a durational thing. And so in that way, it did feel like almost like a performance, or like an object, and less like a story or narrative. And so, yeah, I felt this like huge loss. And I think I still sometimes like associate, I'm also deeply out of that headspace. I'm so lucky to be able to hear and to be in this space of remission. And so I feel removed from the space in which I wrote the kind of ground of the book. Mm-hmm. But sometimes there will be kind of moments where I feel like, oh, this will go in the book, and it's gone. I feel like it's this thing that's not there anymore, which is also good, because that I'm happy for that performance to be over.
I was also just going to ask about that because, you know, I talk to so many authors who seem so ready to, I don't know if relinquish control would be the term that I would use, but are ready to set the novel out, to set the work out and let it become something else for other people. How do you feel now that your book is officially out in the world to be interpreted by other people? Do you still feel like it is acutely yours, or have you relinquished? Are you in the process of relinquishing?
Yeah, I think I do feel a distance from it now, and again from this headspace. And I think it you know, was finished, you know, several months ago now. And it was really like then when I like sent over and kind of signed it away that I mm-hmm. felt this like loss in relation to just this thing that had held me through something, in relation to kind of what you were asking before, when people kind of are going through a time, and I'd realized like that was the thing that had held me through it. Mm. So to kind of give up this like companion in some way was sad, but also was also good, because I was like, I don't need it anymore. I need something else. And whatever that will be, remains to be seen how that manifests and what is made next. But yeah, I think it feels definitely odd to have it out in the past few weeks. I've had several friends reading it and people engage in it. It is, of course, very close in many ways to my own story. And there are people mm-hmm. in the book who are very close to people in my life. There are people in the book who are in my life. And then there are completely invented characters in the book. But yeah, I think ultimately it feels nice to give away and to not like own as my own anymore. I think will allow for a new thing to emerge.
So I was also going to ask you how the experience had changed your perspective. What kind of positive outcomes have you found from it? And please feel free to answer those. But I do think you have already. And so I might amend that question to ask, how do you think this experience changed your style as a writer, and how will it influence your style going forward?
Yeah, I mean, this was the, I've been someone who's written with like a lot of brevity. I hadn't written anything longer than like 3 pages, other than like required essays for school at earlier points in my life. So, but I think that my writing, I don't know if like the style of the writing, which is something that I'm not really exactly conscious of, is just, probably some form of constant, but I do think my relationship just to my body in a room, is definitely different. And I think that will kind of inherently affect how I write or make or think. It's just a kind of a shift in awareness for better or for worse. It's just kind of like once you've experienced one thing, you're not gonna unexperience that. So yeah, I think again, attention to kind of certain listening, and yeah, it was a hallucinatory experience. I mentioned this, but like I've actually never done psychedelics before, mm-hmm. but it did feel really akin to like a long extended like trip, because I had my consciousness was altered, and I was alone in an experience, which is something that, you know, everyone's drug experience is like their own. Like I was, and so I think there's just a kind of perspectival shift. I think the way I associate or listen is different. And I think I also realistically live constantly in some way low level with the fear of it returning and of leaving, of being out of remission. They don't understand. They don't understand the disease. They know what's happening, but not why. And you know, they know it's this kind of inflammatory thing, but they don't know what sets it off initially and how to kind of, I'm in a treatment program, but they don't understand why. So I do think I also live kind of perpetually with this fear of a return, to that state. And yeah, so I think there is that kind of constant thing that's there and has definitely waned with the distance, but I definitely will find myself like waking up and being like, can I hear? or being on an airplane or when you have a cold and your hearing naturally shifts just like anyone else does, I think it kind of heightens a certain awareness of what's happening or kind of a fear is kind of triggered or comes up. And so I think living, like, there are a lot of people who live in fear of things returning or remembering something that was like acutely painful. And I was very lucky to live the first 25 years of my life without having an experience that something can kind of arrive at a surface so readily, when brought up, this kind of, for lack of a better word, like a trigger point. And I think I have a more intimate, understanding of what it is to like live in the world with that kind of level of gravity of experience that, that many people do have, and many people don't. And so it's kind of this interesting thing that people silently carry. But I feel lucky to actually have that and know that because I feel more able to relate to people who have had kind of these more kind of intense durational experiences, relating to their body or to loss or grief in some way.
Well, Eliza, that is it for today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining.
A positive note to end on.
I know. I was also kind of like, but I will take it. It was fascinating to read this experience, and to talk to you. And I really only asked that last question because I am eager and so deeply curious to see what you do next.
Thank you.
Thank you for all of this.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for the great questions.
Thank you, listeners.